We have one remaining matter on our oral calendar for today. I'll ask our marshal to call the case.
Calling 824-0699, Rebecca Niebuhr versus Timothy Seberg.
Take your time setting up, just some housekeeping. You each have 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief. 5 minutes is reserved for, did I say 15 minutes? 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal if you choose to opt for that. Please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your arguments. The podium has also been adjusted by different speakers today, so feel free to find the switch and move it to your
I'm pretty desired. Sure I'll be looking for the button.
Move it to what is most comfortable for you. Mr. Wilson, when you're ready, take your time, Mr. Wilson, but when you're ready, go ahead.
This was a tall advocate. I actually
yes.
have to lower the podium just to see the time. All right. Well, may it please the court. I am Scott Wilson. I represent the appellant Rebecca Niebuhr on behalf of the next of kin of Jason Niebuhr. She is present with us in the courtroom today. Also with me is my co-counsel, Renee Rubish, who is seated to my right. Judge Werke.
Yes, you know I was a part of the panel that made the decision that you're saying was wrongfully decided. You also recognize now Chief Justice Natalie Hudson wrote the opinion.
Yes, indeed.
You're going to have to work hard to convince me why that was wrongly decided.
Yeah, and I'm prepared to do that work today. Only you and now Chief Justice Hudson and Judge Kalitowski know the mechanics of the decision, know actually how the decision was reached. But I'm going to provide an explanation. That is that there is a common misconception in the law of agency, which is that where an agent is not liable, as distinct from not negligent, then the principal simply cannot be liable. It's kind of like everybody knows that, except as the briefing shows in this case, there's a heck of a lot of law to the contrary. There's law in this state stretching from 1936 to 2015. There are four restatement sections in the draft of a fifth, and there is the majority law in other jurisdictions in the United States. And my explanation, Judge Werke, for what happened in Guess is that none of that was provided to this court 18 years ago. And the reason I'm being arrogant enough to say that is because I know that if that law had been provided, you and the other two members of the panel would have given us more than two paragraphs and three case citations. You would have addressed that law if it had been briefed. So I assert that today is the first real airing of the issue, whether co-employee immunity in a permissive driver is properly imputed to a vehicle owner. And here's my honest sense of that law. Generally, immunity that is personal to an agent, and that means immunity that's based on an agent's status that isn't shared with the principal, isn't imputed to the principal. And because you got to have some kind of a shorthand for that, I call that the non-imputation principle. Now, that's supported by Minnesota law, by the multiple evolving restatements I referenced, and by the majority law of other jurisdictions. Specifically, the issue we got here, co-employee immunity, is not imputed to otherwise liable vehicle owners, and that is supported by a majority of other jurisdictions addressing that specific question at the proportion of 5-2. By the way, I have to apologize, it's not 5-3. I was wrong when I wrote my principal brief. I included the Florida case. Just real quickly, because this clarification's got to be made since I was wrong in my principal brief. The Florida case, Smith, doesn't address co-employee immunity at all. What drove that decision, I didn't notice it. I must have been running on automatic when I read it. I didn't notice it until I prepared for today's oral argument. What that decision turns on is the fact that the employer in that case was statutorily released by the Florida Workers' Compensation Act. So it's a statutory release in the statute. So that employer is released, and then because of that release, the lessor of the vehicle, which is the owner of the two motorcycles involved, couldn't be sued. It was just a coincidence that the case involved co-employees. So it's really properly 5-2. So what we come down, yeah.
That case aside, in respondent's brief and as a part of the prior determination of this court, co-employee immunity is important because it allows an employee to sue a co-employee for simple negligence. And the concern is that it shifts, by allowing that to happen, it shifts the responsibility in a manner never intended by the workers' compensation scheme. And that has to do with the Stringer holding. So I'm hung up on that because the workers' compensation statute is a specific design for the state courts in Minnesota, and it seems to be operative when you have this situation. I don't know that there's an issue as far as the scope of employment if the driver and the decedent were not in the course of employment. It seems to be pretty obvious.
Yes.
So I do have a question here. I want you to reflect on the workers' compensation. The question I have for you is, had the decedent purchased workers' compensation for himself rather than simply his employees, would that make a difference? I don't know that it does, and I'm wondering mm-hmm. what you think of that.
My response is that it would not make a difference. That's because the vehicle owners in this case, Timothy and Michelle Seberg, aren't a part of the employment at all, and they aren't a part of the workers' compensation bargain at all. To a limited extent, the co-employee is, and that's what drove the decision in Stringer. But vehicle owners are entirely outside of the bargain. The reason I don't think that the existence of coverage...
So in kind of a way, you're saying vehicle owners and the whole realm of things having to do with vehicular operation supersedes workers' comp?
That language hasn't occurred to me, but I would sign on to that, Judge. And here's my explanation. The Safety Responsibility Act has been with us for 100 years, and the policy is powerful, actually. The Supreme Court has told us that the act exists to create an approximate certainty of recovery in motor vehicle accident victims, like my client, the mother of the person who died here. And that is a clearly remedial statute, which is subject to liberal interpretation. The law has said that over and over and over in the state of Minnesota. Well, the Workers' Compensation Act, on the other hand, is an expressly non-remedial statute, Section 176.001, in that section, the legislature told us this is not a remedial statute, this is not subject to liberal interpretation, only even-handed interpretation. And then we're talking about co-employee immunity. And if you look at the dissent in Stringer, which obviously isn't the law, but it does point out something important for us. If you look at the dissent in Stringer, what gets teased out is the fact that co-employee immunity, well, it's important, is peripheral to the workers' compensation bargain. It is a supplemental immunity that is granted to support workers' compensation exclusivity. It's late added. It wasn't fully in place until 1979 when they amended the statute. So you've got a peripheral immunity in a statute that is expressly non-remedial, and then you're looking at non-employee vehicle owners, in this case and presumably in many other cases, where there's very clear policy and where the statute very clearly imposes liability.
Can you address kind of the difference in this context with the immunity versus, now I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it, Pairinger releases, if that's the right pronunciation. Where there it seems like the court has, and this is the Redon case that the guest decision relies on, right? And my understanding of that issue is basically that, you know, a release of the agent is meaningless to some degree if the principal can go and just sue them for indemnification. So why isn't that the same here? And I understand that there's a difference in the type of release, but like as a legal, like why does it make sense that there's a difference here between how we look at immunity and a release in that context?
That's a great question. It's easier for me to distinguish Redon than it is for me to distinguish the two parallel scenarios, which is what you're asking me to do. But there is an important distinction. By the way, as an old tort guy, I'll help you. It's Pairinger.
Thank you. I had a feeling that was
right. Yeah. Wisconsin case. But anyway, here's the distinction. It's a functional distinction. In a Pairinger, if you release the agent in a Pairinger and you don't release the principal and expect to make a claim against the principal, which is a mistake that my colleagues make from time to time, if you do that, you destroy the release entirely. And you create a circuity of obligation, right? You've got the plaintiff suing, recovering from the principal then recovers an indemnity from the agent then is indemnified under the Pairinger and recovers back against the plaintiff. So money changes hands three times and no difference is made. So you can't have a Pairinger and not release the principal. There's another reason as well, which is in the Hoffman decision, which was decided the same year as Redon, and that's that if you release the agent, you are necessarily releasing the percentage of fault that the vicariously liable principal would be responsible for. So the principal's liability conceptually goes away. So you just can't have that release. It doesn't work. In our scenario, however, you absolutely can have a workers' compensation system. And you can have an employer who has the benefit of the workers' compensation grand bargain. What's happening here is that you have, you have the Safety Responsibility Act and the terms and the policy of that being honored. The owners are liable as they are supposed to be, and there is potentially some incursion into the system through the co-employee. But as I say, that's a peripheral incursion. It's an incursion that should happen under that disproportional policy analysis that I gave you. And on top of it, it's something that is typically not going to happen. It can't happen in this case, and it's not going to happen because usually when you're going to have a loaned vehicle, a vehicle loaned by a non-employer in a work accident, it's going to be a family car. Like it was here, and everyone is going to be insured by the same insurance company, which cannot seek subrogation against a co-insured under the law and doesn't want to anyway. So you won't see an indemnity claim back against the driver in this case, and you won't see it in most cases.
I take your point on the facts of this case, but if we're being called to interpret the immunity provision kind of broadly, I mean, it would apply to any kind of factual scenario, presumably when there wasn't a co-insurance. So you agree that there could be an indemnity action in another set of facts that would effectively render the co-employee immunity, irrelevant
in that circumstance.
And that still, you think, is consistent with the work. And I guess this is to Judge Werke's point about with consistent with how the Workers' Compensation Act was intended to operate.
Right. I think that there is some impairment, some incursion into the workers' compensation fortress in that scenario. I think it happens rarely, and I think that it's consistent with the overall pattern of the law. The Safety Responsibility Act on one hand, liberal statute, powerful policy, workers' compensation statute on the other hand, and what's at stake is a peripheral aspect.
Is one way to think about the Perringer release differently, that's a matter of contracting between the parties or intent of the parties as to what they, you know, whether that if the agent, you know, in effect wouldn't have entered such a contract, such a settlement agreement or a release agreement if they had known or if they were subject to indemnification?
I think
this is a creature of statute.
Yeah, I think that supports, that contract analysis supports the result. I do want to point out, and this is in the briefing, I do want to point out that other courts have looked at this dichotomy. The Iowa court in 2021 looked at this and said, yeah, the owner gets released in a Perringer, but is still doesn't get immunity in a non-Perringer situation. So it looked at the same dichotomy and came out in a way that supports our position and pointed to the state of California, which has done exactly the same thing. So I'm blinking yellow here.
We have 22 seconds left. So let me pose this question to
you. All right.
So if we buy if we agree with you, is it not true then that a liable owner of a vehicle could then go back against a driver of a vehicle, and I'm not talking about parents and son as in this case, but in the big scheme of things, an owner then could go back against a driver, and I find that to be at odds with workers' compensation. So
right.
Your time is up. How about you think about that and come back?
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I'm representing respondents Michelle Seberg and Tim Seberg. I want to start with a question that Judge Werke raised, which is, what is the effect of the fact that the decedent chose not to purchase workers' compensation insurance for himself? That actually makes a huge difference here, because under 176.061, subdivision 5D, which is the section that allows employees to bring actions against third parties, it says the third party is not liable to any person other than the employee or the employee's dependents or the employer or the special compensation fund for any damages resulting from the injury or death. Now, appellant is the mother of the decedent, who's a middle-aged man. She's not a dependent. So the parents would be immune from her claim under that subdivision if he had purchased workers' compensation insurance for himself. So what this case is really about is trying to take advantage of the fact that, you know, he didn't do that as a way to shift liability onto the parents of the 17-year-old child that he employed.
But just to talk about that point, so there's no argument here that this claim was brought under those provisions, right, because benefits weren't paid out. But if anything, I guess I'm looking at those third-party statute or provisions as maybe cutting a different way, and maybe you can help me explain why I shouldn't. But doesn't that acknowledge within the workers' comp scheme that third parties may be liable outside, that there are avenues outside of this bargain between the employer and the employee, and that there, so the statute in some sense contemplates, you know, then maybe, I don't know if this goes to what Judge Werke was just asking about or not, but it contemplates third-party liability in some cases. So help me understand, just like from a statutory scheme, as to why, and maybe another way to put this is, there's no exclusivity provision in the workers' comp scheme saying that the only way that somebody who's injured can recoup for damages is through workers' comp. Right? It is certainly against the employer.
Yes, so it contemplates third-party liability, but it also places limits on it. And so that's why, you know, you look at the statute, it says, you know, you can't bring a claim unless you're a dependent. And so, you know,
but even isn't that, again, like if the benefits have been paid out, presumably they've been paid out to the injured employee or to their dependents under the policy. Right. So that's like kind of explains that language that we were talking about, paid out benefit. And maybe I'm kind of in my head about this, but I'm just kind of, that to me is why the language is talking about dependents. But maybe I'm misunderstanding something there.
So I think maybe to look at it from a different angle, the Workers' Compensation Act allows a narrow group of people to choose not to purchase workers' compensation insurance. But the idea of allowing them to do that is so that they can take on the risk themselves. It's not so that they can suddenly open up liability to other people who would otherwise not be liable if they had purchased that insurance. And so I think the idea that by choosing not to purchase liability insurance, you can then make the parents of the employee liable when they otherwise would not be, just runs contrary to the entire scheme of workers' compensation insurance. Also, the idea of co-employee immunity is an important feature of the Workers' Compensation Act. It's not some sort of add-on afterthought, as appellants attempt to argue. It's not a recent addition. It's been around for 45 years. That's by no means recent. And even prior to that amendment expressly adding it, the liability of co-employees was severely limited under the common law through the personal duty requirement and other mechanisms. And that's why the Stringer Court says of the amendment adding co-employee immunity that it was added because it was never intended to allow tort liability to shift from employer to employee. That's why, you know, we made this express. So again, it's not some add-on. It's fundamental to the idea of workers' compensation. And if that immunity is to mean anything, it has to apply to the vehicle owners here. Because as this court pointed out, otherwise the owners, the drivers, the parents would have an indemnity claim against the driver, and that negates the entire purpose of co-employee immunity. Now, appellant argues, you know, if there was insurance and if they were covered under the same policy and if there was no exclusions and if it was within policy limits, there would be no indemnity claim. But again, this court is looking at generally applicable rules of liability, and it shouldn't assume that there's always going to be that insurance aspect to the case. We're talking about who's liable and who's not. And so you can't consider insurance and sort of laying down those rules. Appellants also relying a lot on the Safety Responsibility Act, of course, for the argument that vehicle owners are liable. It's not an absolute rule. I think it's undisputed that if the vehicle had been titled in Jacob's name, the driver, he would still be entitled to immunity under the Work Comp Act. So it's not true that the Safety Responsibility Act always makes somebody liable, and it wouldn't be contrary to the Act to impute that immunity here. Notably, unlike some states that use the specific language, shall be liable, Minnesota's statute doesn't say that. It just says that the driver is deemed to be an agent. And so that leaves it open to the courts to decide whether the owner is liable or not, given the circumstances. And of course, this...
So, one other way to think about it, when you're thinking about the safety... So, you know, you posed the scenario where he owned his car, and then he would have been able to benefit from the immunity, right? But you could just as easily look at the flip side of that, which is he wasn't at work, and he was driving his parents' car, and it was a friend in the car who they got in an accident and who didn't survive. And in that scenario, there would be no dispute that the parents would be liable through the agency, through the Safety Responsibility Act, right? So, I mean, in the end, it's kind of looking at who's benefiting from the workers' comp immunity. Is it just the employee, or does it extend to the parents? Right. So I guess I'm trying, it kind of depends, and maybe this is part of that balancing the two statutes, is how do you read them together? And I think you can flip them both in ways that feel like there are inequities involved, and that's part, maybe just part of the fact that they're trying to reach, coming at it from different sides. But how do you address that kind of?
I think the difference is that when you're driving for work, I mean, especially in a business where you're doing deliveries, you're driving a lot and it's like work related, and so that should be a cost that's borne by the business. If the parents choose to give the vehicle to the child to drive to school, for example, and there's an accident, that's different because it's not a business cost. And so business costs, you know, are this area of law that we've carved out and put into the workers' compensation system.
But then again, you still then have the other third-party liability in the statute, right? Which says that, and I understand your argument that those don't apply here. But in the third-party provisions, let's say this was a dependent bringing an action and the benefits had been paid out. There could be a lawsuit against a third party to bear the cost of that work relationship or that work conduct, right? So why should we accept that in that context but not in the co-employee?
Well, the third party would have to have some liability. The third party's been negligent or caused the harm in some ways. It's different when here we're talking about a statute that deems the parents to be a principal by legal fiction, and it's a vicarious liability only for acts that were taken by the employee within the scope of their employment. I think that's a lot different than the typical action against a third party, which would be some third party who's done something negligent and then caused an injury to somebody who was within the course of their employment. I think that's perhaps one way to think about that issue. I also want to address the guest opinion. That case did decide this exact issue. And, of course, Judge Werke, I know you know the case better than any of us, but...
No offense by appellate briefing, and I appreciate the respondent briefing on the value of unpublished decisions.
I would just say that from what we can tell from the face of the opinion, it does say that the parties made various arguments on this issue, and so I think that it's speculation to assume that this wasn't fully briefed. I mean, this court has said in many opinions that it's not going to reach issues that aren't fully briefed, and it reached this issue. It decided this issue. So
if that is the hat that you're wearing, and if, in fact, we would agree that gas would be not controlling because it's a non-precedential opinion, what nugget would you give us as far as a syllabus point for a precedential opinion that we may issue if we would decide in your favor?
So I think a syllabus point could read when an employee is entitled to co-employee immunity under the Work Comp Act, that the owner of a vehicle cannot be vicariously liable, something along those
somehow
lines.
Somehow distinguishing workers' compensation in its umbrella from the SRA?
Yeah, I think it focuses on the workers' compensation as a different area, because I think that's a huge difference between workers' compensation cases versus, for example, the spousal immunity cases. It's a very different context. I mean, courts were bending over backwards to limit spousal immunity cases as much as possible, and that's why I think we get a lot of that different reasoning that may not apply to a statutory immunity like co-employee immunity. I think it's interesting when appellant finally focuses on the co-employee immunity cases, the count of the case law from across the country changes. They said 5-3 in their reply brief. That doesn't count Minnesota if we conclude the guest decision, 5-4, and we've distinguished some of the cases they cite. So it's really a toss-up. The cases are divided on this issue when it comes to co-employee immunity.
So can I bring you back to the Miller decision again? Because I find your point interesting that there's something just different about spousal immunity. what was the holding of Miller? Like, what is binding? Because that is indisputably binding to us. So the question is that distinguishable from this case? And what was the holding that that you know shows that it doesn't apply here? How do we distinguish it?
Well, yes. So that was a spousal immunity case held that the plaintiff wife could recover against the vehicle owner despite the fact that she didn't have a claim against her husband, who was the driver, because of spousal immunity. I think it can be distinguished for a number of reasons. One is that spousal immunity was largely disfavored under the law and has since been overruled. Two is that it's a common law immunity. So the court wasn't concerned as much about, you know, limiting it because the court has the ability to do that. Whereas here with a statutory immunity, when you start to see that you could come into the issue of the indemnity claim against the driver, which eliminates the purpose of the immunity, that is running into conflict with the statute. And the courts aren't free to limit immunities in the same way that they can with common law immunities.
So the thing about I certainly take those points. What I find challenging about Miller is that it seems to root its decision not in the immunity, the kind of immunity, or the reason why the agent isn't, maybe liable is not even the right word, it just isn't, that you can't recoup against the agent. It talks about that agency-principal relationship. And so I guess, you know, and I'm trying to find the exact kind of like part of the, this is on, at like, let's see, in Miller at page 325, 326, where it's talking about no liability can attach to the principal or master. Excuse me. If the negligent act resolves itself into injury to another, and the actor occupies a position which makes him immune to recovery, that alone should not relieve the principal or master. And then it talks like he may be, you know, he may die, he may go to bankruptcy, all these reasons why you can't recoup around. So it's not really even limiting it to spousal immunity there. It's kind of looking at that, like, for whatever reason, just because you can't recoup against the agent doesn't mean that it relieves the principal agent. So how do you, that's like where I'm struggling with trying to distinguish it here. And I know that you're out of time if you don't mind.
Okay. Go ahead, you can answer her question.
Thank you.
I think how I would answer that is similar to the response of the restatements, and that is that the law in this area is really all developed from spousal immunity. So even if they're talking about it in terms of agency relationship, or where did those agency kind of principles come from, it all came from spousal immunity cases. And I think there's a good reason to be super suspect of the reasoning in those cases that deal with spousal immunities, because it was kind of a stain on our history that type of immunity existed. And so I don't think that if this issue went to the Supreme Court that it would necessarily come out the same way, and I don't think that this court should find itself bound by Miller here any more than it did in the Guess case. So for those reasons, we would ask that the court reaffirm its decision in Guess and affirm the district court's decision here.
Thank you.
Judge Werke, I do have a few things that just a few things that I want to make sure I say, but you ended with a question you wanted me to address, and it seems like that's job one for me. So could you restate the question for me?
I was asking you if your scheme of things is such that an owner would then, could an owner of a vehicle then go back against the driver, and forgetting that this is a parent son, an owner of a vehicle, anybody, against a driver, and would that not be at odds with the workers' compensation umbrella? Because the driver, of course, in the workers' compensation would have been protected.
I think unless the court upstairs, if we get there, decides to carve out an indemnity exception, I think that's a hole in the umbrella. in the workers' compensation umbrella, absolutely. What I'm saying is that it's a necessary hole in light of the overall legal scheme, which includes the Remedial Safety Responsibility Act, the non-remedial Workers' Compensation Act, and then this, you know, co-employee immunity, which is important but peripheral. The central immunity.
What do you envision as a meaningful syllabus point in the event?
I'm sorry. Say again.
What do you see as a meaningful syllabus point that either resolves the case in your client's favor or something that the Supreme Court would look at? I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, that's okay. I think the meaningful syllabus point would be to say that Miller versus J.A. Tireholm remains the law of the state of Minnesota.
And I can tell you it's Tireholm. I grew up in Waseca. It was Tireholm Ford.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm just saying that because you're the tort guy and
yeah, and I know how to pronounce Behringer. Okay. Behringer, yeah, excuse me. That would be the simple syllabus point that I would in my heart be hoping for, you know, if a published decision comes down from this court. And I believe it is the law of the state, by the way. So really quickly, first of all, I'm wrong again. You asked me at the top, you know, would it make any difference if he had coverage? And yes, of course it would make a difference because benefits would have been paid out and there would be a subrogation claim and the whole third party scheme would apply. I'm not at all clear, however, that it would make a difference to Rebecca Niebuhr's right to bring a claim because of the simple fact that that scheme from 0615B through 0615D and on in that complicated statute, that scheme applies to employees and dependents who have received benefits. She is not an employee or a dependent. And I would assert that that statute doesn't apply to her at all as the wrongful death trustee.
From a statutory interpretation point about the workers' comp scheme that doesn't, allowing for relief here basically disincentivizes someone to purchase workers' comp insurance because in the end, if you don't pay out, they can, instead of then recouping against the employer, they could, go after a third party.
I think that would be more of a concern if this scenario, remember, I meant what I said. I think this is the first time this question's been before the court fully. And we're a long way down the road from the birth of the Workers' Compensation Act and the birth of the Automobile and the Safety Responsibility Act. If this was a common scenario, then I think that there'd be a disincentive, but I really doubt that any potential workers' compensation insured is gonna sit at his or her desk and say, well, you know, I think I'm gonna forego that expense because if I'm injured by a co-employee in a vehicle that is owned by a non-employer, I would have an avenue of recovery. I just think it's too many twists around the pole.
I know you're running out of time. Just one other question.
Sure.
I'm curious if you could respond to the point about Miller being really about spousal immunity, and that was kind of a different animal, and maybe there's just something different. I mean, there wasn't another scheme. There wouldn't have been a workers' comp, mechanism for somebody to recover. So really you had to, if you didn't have like the, If immunity could be imputed to the principal there, that was it. Whereas here, at least, there is a workers' comp scheme that maybe not on the facts of this case, but in another situation,
yeah,
there could be some kind of... So why isn't that just different than this?
I'm blinking red. Can I answer your question
answer,
and
yes.
Then sit down? So that was actually the point I wanted to get to, the question that you're asking. The assertion is being made that Miller and four restatements and the draft of a fifth in 2023... should all be disregarded because they've been hanging out in the wrong neighborhood with spousal immunity. First of all, that's not a reasoned argument. But secondly, the reason you see the birth of these doctrines around the issue of imputation of immunity in the spousal immunity context is because it was disfavored. It was a hotbed of litigation. And so it became a laboratory for those principles. But the restatement sections are in no way limited to spousal immunity, and the body of case law is in no way limited to spousal immunity. So yeah, it's good that spousal immunity was abolished in the state of Minnesota in 1980, but it has nothing to do with this case. And it has nothing to do with the consistent restatement of the law over 8 decades, and it has nothing to do with the decisions, the 5 decisions in other jurisdictions that have decided that in this circumstance, where the driver has co-employee immunity, the owner is still liable. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple of comments. Ms. Neubauer, you're in the audience. I just want to say that this court certainly understands that sometimes you come and you hear the legal nuances being discussed here back and forth, but we appreciate the loss of your son, Jason, and how meaningful and tragic that is. He seems to have been a remarkable person based on what we have read. To counsel, it's always a joy to have skilled attorneys that are well-briefed, well-knowledgeable about the subject matter, and can sometimes dig themselves out of a hole, and do very well in terms of oral argument. It was a very enjoyable discourse that we had today. Now, with that said, this court will stand in adjournment.
Thank you, Jim.
All rise.